Broadcasting from WIOX LP Bloomington, welcome to American Student Radio. I'm your host for this week, Nissa Cruz. On today's show, we're exploring the concept native. What does native mean in a national sense? A local sense? What does it mean culturally? And how do people negotiate this identity against the expectations of others? Stay tuned to find out.
What is it?
Oh, ready?
Should I do it again?
From Indiana University in Bloomington.
This is
American Student Radio.
Real chill. Aliens, conspiracy, journalism, and lesbians.
Home is a concept inextricably tied to being native. In our first piece, producer Carter Barrett asked students what home means to them. Music in this story is courtesy of Poddington Bear.
Home to me is wherever I can be around all my friends and my family and be surrounded by them. Wherever they are, that's where I consider my home.
Where is your literal home?
Oh, literal place? Bloomington, Indiana. I don't particularly like to go home to Bedford, my small southern Indiana town. Very often I prefer Bloomington.
My home I would consider to be Brownsburg, Indiana, which is right outside of Indianapolis. That's my home because that's where I grew up. A lot of my memories of my childhood and the way that where I originally made my closest friends and a lot of those fundamental years in my life are there. I think that there'll always be an element of home there. But if my mom moves or my family moves elsewhere, I'm sure that home will change. I think home is wherever people that I love are, so I think it's not a very static place. It can move around.
Home for me, I'd say, is Bloomington, Indiana, because that's where I have made my home with my best friends. It's where my school is and my job is, and it's kind of where my whole life revolves around right now. I don't think it'll always be the first thing that comes to mind when I think of home, but I think it will always have a place in my heart.
Home is any place where you feel comfortable enough to be yourself and where you're surrounded by loved ones who you can lean on. I think literally my home is back in my hometown, Kendallville, Indiana. That's where I'm most comfortable and where I feel that I have a big support group. Once I have a family of my own, I think it might change. I don't know how that dynamic will be, but I do think that'll be my home until then.
So what is a native anyway? Does the identity hinge on location of birth, or culture, or maybe ancestry? Judging by the history of the United States, it's probably fair to say being, quote, native can mean a variety of things. In this next piece, ASR producer Emily Miles talks with someone in the middle of deciphering the question of what it means to be native, an undocumented student.
So I'm an undocumented student. I was born in Mexico. And I migrated to the United States when I was 2 years old. I wouldn't consider myself to be Mexican. I wouldn't really consider myself to be, like, American. I'm a Chicana. That's what I am. I'm a mix of two different cultures. And I guess that still makes me American because that's all America is. It's mixes of a lot of different people, a lot of different cultures.
Here at IU, she's not alone. Many students and professors at the university are undocumented immigrants. Broadly, there are about 11 million undocumented people in the country today, paying taxes and working and studying. For them, wading through the U.S.'s dual history of openness and nativism is not new, but the waves are changing.
I mean, it was always there. It's always been there, but now it's a lot more predominant. And it wasn't until Trump won that I was actually, like, fearful for my life for the first time ever. Like, I've never feared deportation before because I haven't done anything wrong. But now, just by being who I am, I could be deported. I have to think about the fact that one day ICE could show up in my doorstep and could arrest me. I have to think about my family and, like, if my parents were to be deported, what would happen to my siblings? What would happen to, like, the younger family members, my godchild?
Historically, in the United States, we've had a relatively open immigration policy that
allows for individuals to naturalize under certain conditions, but we also have birthright citizenship here. And that's rare. Now, that said, in the United States, there's also been a history of restrictions on the naturalization of non-white persons. That's been around for most of our history, but also restrictions on just the simple immigration of individuals. We have the Chinese Exclusion Acts in the 1880s. We also had restrictions, immigration quotas that were set in the 1920s. Most of that, however, was repealed in the 1960s. At the same time that that happened, however, there was a renewed focus on immigration from Latin America, kind of reinforcement of the border, more enforcement of transit of people from Mexico to the U.S., and in some ways that created the current situation where we say that some individuals are not documented or undocumented.
That's Bernard Fraga, an assistant professor in the IU Department of Political Science.
Historically, some of the arguments that were made against immigration were that immigrants would change the nature of American society. We saw this in the 1840s and 1850s with fears about immigrants from Ireland, immigrants from Germany, from Southern Europe, from Eastern Europe even. Now we look at that and we say those kinds of restrictions are, you know, just not politically feasible and in fact make, you know, those immigrants make America what it is today.
Today, we have similar debates about Latin American immigrants. Many in opposition say they speak a different language.
Have a different culture that will change American fundamental ways. So that's one set of criticisms has really been about the cultural dimension. And I think that the opposition to that has primarily been that's nativism or xenophobia or fear of cultural change. The other set of criticisms of immigration has been on economic terms, the idea that immigrants might change the labor market in the United States. But the scientific data on that is that that's not really the case.
One of the things that I can think of just of how people have misconceptions of undocumented people in general is that we benefit from the government, which we do not at all. We don't get welfare. I don't have health insurance. I can't really go to school. Not really. I can barely have a job. Yeah.
But she does go to school and she does work hard.
Over the summers, I work in factories and I work like overtime and I work like pretty hard jobs in order to raise enough money to save up and go to school for one semester. And then apart from that, I also have to work in order to pay for my living expenses and food and gas and stuff like that.
In fact, immigrants tend to fill jobs that native-born Americans would not take or do not have the skills to do. And in fact, that immigrants contribute a tremendous amount to our economy and actually help grow our economy.
Evidence aside, the patterns of nativism do not relent, and undocumented people are among those who pay the most.
I just kind of figured it out by myself sometime in middle school. They were offering 21st century scholars, and I fulfilled all the requirements. I was eligible for it, except I did not have a Social Security number at that time. I didn't understand really why I didn't have one or why I was so different from everyone, but that's kind of how I started thinking about my status.
But the gravity hadn't hit yet.
None of it affected me at that point because everything was still paid for. I tried my best in school. That's all I really did up until my senior year when I realized that it was a problem. And it was a very big problem.
A problem because in Indiana, undocumented students are completely cut out of state financial aid. This makes paying for college nearly impossible.
Oftentimes it takes like working throughout the summer, working a full-time job when you're doing full-time school. The scarier thing with Trump is that when DACA starts to expire, students won't be able to work anymore, at least legally. If they want to work, they'd have to work under the table, which of course gets complicated and is more difficult to find and is a lot easier to be abused under those circumstances.
That's Willie Palomo. He helps lead the Undocu-Hoosier Alliance, an organization dedicated to advocating for undocumented immigrants. He references DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Essentially, it's a way for people who are brought into the U.S. as children to stay here as long as they meet certain guidelines. It's necessary because, as of now, there is virtually no path to citizenship for an undocumented person.
And I just want to say that DACA was not what Dreamers intended to happen for immigration. That's not our end goal at all.
Then there's the DREAM Act, which has unsuccessfully been bouncing around Congress for years. If it were passed, it would give those who are brought to the U.S. as children the opportunity to earn citizenship.
Well, I can't really hope if it's very imminent. And we know that Trump is going to do something with DACA.
She says an elimination of DACA would change her life.
My life? Can't work. I can't have a car or a license.
There's a lot of communities that would have to go into the shadows. Like, when you can't work legally anymore, like, and you can't afford to leave, then what you do is find illegal work, right? The abuses that are possible when, like, people are living in the shadows are really real and threatening. There's a fear of deportation, of families being torn apart. Yeah, along with not being able to, like, have a car or a valid form of ID, there's just a lot of things that you are socially X'd out of that you have to hustle in order to, like, find ways to get.
But Palomo says people can't give in to fatalism.
One of the things we can admire about going forward is that, like, there has been a lot of social activism around this. When communities organize and if they pull together to start advocating for undocumented people, for the people who are most vulnerable and who are going to be under attack through this new administration, there is a lot of work and resources we can provide. We are not powerless, and we've never been powerless.
For American Student Radio in Bloomington, I'm Emily Miles.
Our next story focuses on a different idea of being Native. While many of us move far away from our hometowns for college, some have the privilege, or the curse, of finding a university right in their neighborhood. In this story from Pilar Brunarski, perspectives from college town Natives uncover the complications of staying local for higher education.
I grew up in Bloomington, Indiana, and for a very long time, I subscribed to the wholesome, contemporary, white, middle-class American lifestyle, in which I would graduate high school and move on to my faraway, idyllic college campus, leaving my parents empty nesters, and myself a new, independent young man, tackling this next beautiful step in my life, far away from my dull hometown. But that's not what happened. I attend college in Bloomington, Indiana, and I'm what's known as a townie. It's a great place. I'm perfectly happy at IU. This isn't a story about harsh reality or how my privilege hasn't quite taken me where I want. It's a few stories about staying Native for that wonderful college education, how concepts of American post-secondary education affect those of us who already have local access, maybe why we're here in the first place. My friend David is a sophomore like me, and he grew up in Bloomington too. We both live in a residence hall on campus, but unlike me, he had expected to stay local.
To put it bluntly, I did kind of expect to go here, pretty much always. Just like growing up in like this town, because there is like a college here, obviously I always thought college was going to be a thing for me. Like, I never expected that not to be a thing. That was the thing pretty much everyone did. I didn't really know anyone who didn't go to college, or at least not anything like post-secondary education. When it did actually come time to, like, choosing colleges, though, I do think that I, like, kind of always expected to end up at IU. It was kind of an interesting situation.
I asked David if he feels his experience as a local is different from students who have moved to Bloomington for college.
To a certain degree, like, probably with most colleges. Obviously, I don't have experience with another college, but I assume that most colleges, there's kind of, like, a surface layer culture, like, what's promoted, what's purported to be there, and then kind of, like, a deep culture. And I think I was able to, like, kind of sink into that, like, sense of a deep culture more early on, because there's a bit of, like, a gloss to a college. They have, like, all these nice buildings and architecture and all of these things. And I've been living here for a very long time, so the newness of that was just, like, non-existent to me. It was, like, a part of this town for me. Like, I'd always seen it from a distance, and now it's, like, I'm completing my experience of Bloomington.
David's happy with his decision to attend college, but he really feels lucky to be in the right place. The idea of local privilege kept returning. Not only is David very lucky to have this university here, but he actually wants to be here, and that's important. Next, I spoke to Michael O'Daniel.
A psychology major, Bachelor of Science, and I'm a junior? It's pretty wild.
Michael transferred here after studying for 2 years at IU Northwest, a commuter satellite school 15 minutes from his home in Portage, Indiana. Michael's a first-generation college student. He's the first in his immediate family to attend, and he didn't seriously consider going until about halfway through his senior year of high school.
The idea of going away to college, like, freaked me out something tough. I always wanted to go away, because that sounded cool, but it just, like, it was really intimidating. I'm a huge baby when it comes to new stuff and new environments. So yeah, it was like really freaky. It freaked me out. So yeah, instead I went to IU Northwest. It was more like just going with the flow type thing. Okay.
Michael says he certainly saw friends leaving their hometown for college, but he didn't really subscribe to the typical leaving for college trope.
Maybe a little bit of both. Maybe because, like, family, I was, like, working plus school. I didn't really have time to think. I look at college like it was a means to an end, obviously. But rather than, like, learning the knowledge, I was learning how to, like, take the tests at IUN. So I can get a good grade. That way I can get the degree so I can get a better job. So I never really considered it. It was like it's really weird. I come like down here and everything's like really flowy and nice and everyone's like Everyone's wanting to learn things and I'm like, I used to like people wanting to get the grades so they can get a degree and then they can go work for some big company and do that for the rest of their lives. It was just more work than it was learning. It's like here they say like, oh, you gotta like the social life. All these activities, all these things that you can do and experience. It's like very based around experience, like accruing these new experiences, traveling, just getting out there. At IUN, they say, we have hours to fit your work schedule. Like, that's it. Like, that's how it's cheap, it's efficient, and we'll get you out of here quick. That's how IUN markets.
Michael came to Bloomington in part because he wanted to get away. He wanted to stop being a local. And so college for him is an experience beyond the professional and outside lifestyle goals that IU Northwest promoted. He's here for the education, and he's here for the experience. Finally, I spoke to Emma Hamilton, another Bloomington native and sophomore. Like me, Emma did not dislike IU, but looked elsewhere for college. Throughout high school, she was unsure whether she wanted to attend college at all, but settled on IU for financial reasons.
My high school was like... Basically, okay, they would talk to us, I don't even remember, but they talked to us a lot about how, like, you need to go to college. You're going to make more money if you go to college. Especially since IU's, like, a good school, I feel like they were, like, really pushing us to, like, excel at academics. Which is, like, you know, could be a good thing because it can push people to do better in school and, like, have good motivation for school and, like, I don't know. But, maybe it doesn't. But I felt like there was a lot of pressure on me to attend college because it was, like, IU's right here. Like, if you're not going to IU, then, like, go to an Ivy League. Or you're a loser, was basically what it felt like.
The way IU looms over Bloomington contributes to the pressure to attend it, to attend college at all, which is not necessarily the best option for everyone. Should college really be a complete lifestyle experience, as it's promoted at IU Bloomington? Or is it primarily a means to a better end, like Michael found at IU Northwest? I think what's most important is making sure you're here for the right reasons, social, academic, or both.
Being a townie doesn't matter to me as an identity right now as much as it did before because I feel like I know so much more about myself now that I have like other attributes about myself that I can offer that are honestly just a lot cooler than that.
For me and Emma, it's about creating a new identity in an old place. And it turns out finding a very new you in a place that's always held the same sort of you is the real process. Being a local isn't necessarily interesting. It's different, but for some of us, it's turned out to be about shedding our old skin without really being able to walk away from it. Special thanks to Keshko and Springtide for the music in this piece. For American Student Radio in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Peeler Brynjarski.
Our final story for today delves into yet another way to define what it means to be Native, to be Indigenous. In the United States today, there are around 5.5 million Native Americans. The number of these people who speak their Indigenous language is declining, though, leaving Native communities to find new ways to educate young speakers. In the story I produced this week, I explored how IU has helped one Native American community in the language revitalization movement.
language is so inextricably tied to culture that people see a loss of language as a loss of culture. In native tribal groups and native cultures, the language is used to sing the songs. It's used to conduct the ceremonies. It's used to talk to one's creator, because everyone's creator, everyone's God speaks their own language, right? So in that broad sense, the ability to use your language, to knowingly use your language, is an undeniable sign that you are a practitioner of that culture. How Nikki Bell Emachiapi Chanteoshte Nampe Chuzapelo Indiana Owaiwa Wankatuya Woshie Chamu. And so there I'm saying, hi, my name is Nikki Bell. I greet all of you with a warm, heartfelt handshake, and I work at Indiana University.
That was Nikki Bell. He's the director of the First Nations Education and Cultural Center at IU, the unit on campus that supports Native American students. 9 years ago, though, as an IU graduate student, Nikki moved to the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota to be a part of the Lakota Language Preservation and Revitalization. In the last 100 years, there's been a decline in the number of Native Americans who speak their indigenous language. This is largely because, starting in the 1870s, Native kids were shipped off to white-run boarding schools with one goal.
Kill the Indian, save the man.
The white people creating and running the boarding schools thought that if they could strip these children of their native culture, kill the Indian, then maybe the kids could assimilate to mainstream or white American society as adults, save the man. Children at these schools were forced to dress and cut their hair to look white. They were given white names. If they spoke their native language, they could have their mouths washed out with soap, or worse, they could be beaten. These boarding schools were abandoned by the mid-1900s, but their effects are still felt today. Older generations who grew up speaking native languages often refuse to teach their language to their children because they worry their kids might face negative consequences for speaking the language, like they did. As a result, the number of native people who speak their language has decreased over the last 100 years. However, many native communities have hoped in the last 50 years to revitalize their language. This includes the Lakota people who run Red Cloud Indian School on the Pine Ridge Reservation. In 2008, their then superintendent, Robert Braveheart Sr., contacted IU researchers to work as partners to create new curriculum to repopularize Lakota. However, when Nikki arrived at Red Cloud Indian School to act as the liaison between IU and Red Cloud, students were resistant to learning Lakota. He saw some kids making fun of the kids who could speak Lakota because these kids were seen as, quote, more Indian.
Big Indian knows all the words. Oh, aren't you super Indian? All right, chief.
The message from the boarding school reverberated in these kids' words. To be culturally Indian was a bad, shameful thing. Nikki and his Red Cloud partners also had to address the school's language program success rate. Red Cloud School started teaching Lakota in 1969, but by 2008, their program had produced no fluent speakers. So they got to work rewriting the curriculum. Before, kids hadn't been learning Lakota until the 10th grade. Now, the new curriculum started classes earlier and worked Lakota into other environments as well.
A lot of teachers were using projects, classroom activities that tied in with what kids were doing as ways to reinforce the language. You know, teaching kids to text in Lakota, having kids make videos using the language in their media classes. The basketball coach was calling out plays in Lakota instead of English, which was cool because all our team could understand it and the other teams had no idea what our kids were talking about because a lot of them didn't speak the language. So all those kids are saying, oh, well, we better learn what these guys are saying so we know what they're talking about.
Over time, there was a shift in the attitude among the students. Nikki used to see students in the hallways teasing those who spoke Lakota, but by the time he left after 3 years at the school, he saw them in the hallways choosing to talk to each other in Lakota instead of English. The old boarding school idea that being Indian was bad had started to fade, slowly replaced by a new mindset.
Students started to learn how the use of the language wasn't just a marker of some othering identity, but it worked to reinforce one's own identity. And with a stronger sense of self, with a stronger sense of how you connect to your history, to your culture, to your heritage community, students started performing better in school.
And Red Cloud students started to excel in competitions, too. Each year, they travel to the Lakota Nation Invitational, where Indian schools from the area compete in language and academic competitions. For the last few years, Nikki said Red Cloud has dominated, sometimes even sweeping first and second place in some categories.
There was this fun competitive spirit that started to accompany language learning and culture learning even. And it became a fun thing to do. People wanted to win, and you could win by learning your language. You could win by learning more about your culture.
The success of Red Cloud students at Learning Lakota hasn't just been shown through these competitions, though.
Every year there is one company who works with a lot of speaking communities. They do a survey every year. They test all of the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota speaking schools and test them. And every year Red Cloud School is the highest achieving, has the highest grades on that.
Nikki said that across the country today, there are around 5,000 speakers of Lakota and two related languages, Nakota and Dakota. These people range from fully fluent to functionally fluent to conversational, but with more emphasis on Lakota learning in children, like that seen at Red Cloud, these numbers could go up. IU is trying to set up even more connections in Pine Ridge and with Red Cloud. They want to partner on local summer camps and on IU Bridge courses that would bring students to campus in the summer. Ultimately, the partnership hopes to create a pipeline of sorts, where Red Cloud students enroll at IU after high school. As Hoosiers, these students could obviously choose to study anything, but if they wanted, they would have the opportunity to continue studying Lakota through IU's four-semester program, which Nikki will lead starting soon. The Lakota music you heard in this story is called Charge Song. That song is courtesy of Nikki Bell and the Red Cloud Indian School. For American Student Radio in Bloomington, I'm Nissa Cruz. The instrumental music in that piece was courtesy of Poddington Bear. That concludes the show for this week. If you tuned in late or want to listen again, you can always find our shows on iTunes and at soundcloud.com/American-student-radio. Be sure to catch us again next Sunday at noon as host Carter Barrett explores the idea of chance. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to American Student Radio. We're produced by students from Indiana University in Bloomington. Follow us on Twitter at ASR Voice and like us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/American Student Radio. Our theme music is provided by Lunamatic. Check out Lunamatic's music at www.soundcloud.com/Lunamatic. That's Lunamatic. We'll have new episodes every Sunday on WIUX and streaming on our website at www.americanstudentradio.org.